One of the first Tarnished to reach the Round Table is the legendary Vargrim, the Raging Wolf, so named due to the signature wolf pelt that adorned his helmet. Yet there is more to this pelt than meets the eye. It is no mere bauble or vacuous affectation. It is a symbol of Vargrim's true goal. It seems as though Vargrim's aspirations were not to claim the Elden Throne, and even among the myriad schemes of plots amongst his kin, Vargrim's aims stand out as truly unique amongst the Tarnished. Vargrim's endgame is one less of gold, and more of shadow. Each Empyrean, resplendent in their power and allure, are each granted a dark reflection, a warrior beast without equal to enforce their will and enact their plans. The shadow beasts, the very shadow of their masters, part of their very being. In today's video, we are focusing on the Shadowbound, and the relationship they have with their nominated Empyrean. Whilst on the surface it may seem like a fairly straightforward subject, there are a few intricacies and nuances to their creation and relationship that I would like to explore. So, let us start at what I see to be the most logical starting point for this subject, which is how these creatures come to be in the first place. So, let us get the obvious out of the way. The Shadowbound beasts take the form of wolves, a fact confirmed by both Malekith and Blight's appearances, and the Raging Wolf armor description, which reads, "According to the old legends, wolves are the shadows of the Empyrean." While Malekith is the most famous of the Shadowbound, I feel we actually learn more of the life and role of his kind from Blythe, Rani's shadow. Rani herself tells us of how an Empyrean is granted their Shadowbound beast.
"I was once an Empyrean of the demigods. Only I, Mikala, and Melania could claim that title. Each of us was chosen by our own two fingers as a candidate to succeed Queen Marika, to become the new god of the coming age, which is when I received Blythe, in the form of a vassal tailored for an Empyrean. But I would not acquiesce to the two fingers. I stole the Rune of Death, slew mine own Empyrean flesh, casting it away. I would not be controlled by that thing. The two fingers and I have been cursing each other ever since, and the baleful shadows are their assassins."
This bit of dialogue is critical in our understanding of the gestation of such beings. Firstly, it makes it clear that they are granted by the two fingers, and Rani's description goes as far to suggest that their very form is moulded and tailored by the two fingers to suit their Empyrean. For she states, "in the form of a vassal tailored for an Empyrean," as if Blythe himself was formed as he was by the two fingers, specifically to serve suitably as Rani's enforcer. The idea that they are provided to the Empyreans by the greater will is reinforced by what we know of Malekith, for his remembrance reads, "Malekith was a shadow-bound beast given to his Empyrean. Marika's sole need of her shadow was a vessel to lock away destined death. Even then, she betrayed him." The use of shadow-bound is interesting to me, because in combination with Rani's dialogue, it seems clear that these beings are created for the sole purpose of being a bound shadow, a bound creature, to their Empyrean, inexorably linked to their master. E.G. speaks of how Blythe has essentially been Rani's companion from an early age. As he says,
"Blythe is Lady Rani's stepbrother. Rani's mother, Queen Renala, approved of him, and they played like siblings from childhood. They were always happy to have me tag along as well. When Lady Rani renounced her flesh and chose the dark path of the Empyrean, Blythe and I swore allegiance as vassals. But none of us will ever forget our earliest days together."
This shows that Rani must have been selected by the Two Fingers very early on in her life, as was most likely the case with Melania and Mikala, but I've already covered that in more detail in my Mikala video, so I would direct you towards that. The term stepbrother is used, and this is interesting because a similar term is used in reference to Malekith. The description of Malekith's armour reads, "Malekith, Queen Marika's loyal half-brother, bore a blade imbued with destined death, and there was not one demigod who did not fear him." I mentioned before that the word bound interests me, and the reference to a sort of familial tie brings me back to that word choice. Because we need to ask ourselves, why are they referred to as step or half-brothers in Malekith's case? Of course, we shouldn't take this too literally, and if you would indulge me a little bit of speculation, both of these terms imply that one is not necessarily a full brother, but part of an extended family partly connected by blood or circumstance. The very nature of a shadow is that it is part of you, but also distinctly separate from your physical nature. Returning to the word bound, I believe that when these vessels are created, they are created already connected to their Empyrean. They are born from their Empyrean in a way, born as if they are part of them. And this is why Malekith and Blythe appear different, because they are born and bound to a different Empyrean, taking aspects of their Empyrean to form their shadow. When Blythe has his meltdown at the end of Rani's quest, he basically says he could never portray Rani because he is part of her very being. To me, this is why familial terms are used. I believe that the shadows are born of the Empyreans themselves, part of their beings, their shadows, connected to them in a way that makes them a sort of family. Yet what is the purpose and nature of these beasts? How do they behave, and what is their limitations? If we become one of Lady Rani's vassals, we become compatriots with Iji, Celavis, and Blythe. We work closely with the latter to locate the Eternal City of Nokron and retrieve the Finger Slayer Blade. We know that Blythe was created by the Two Fingers, yet Rani has long ago sworn herself as the enemy of the Two Fingers. So what we see is Rani railing against her destiny as an Empyrean, and it shows us that her shadow, whilst the creation of the Greater Will itself, does have some semblance of autonomy, for the description of the Royal Greatsword, Blythe's sword, reads as follows. In defiance of the fate he was born to, Blythe swore to serve no master but Rani. As proof, the sword was imbued with cold magic at the moment the oath was sworn. So despite him essentially being an instrument of the Two Fingers, Blythe chose to serve his master, even as her path would bring him into conflict with his creator and the original reason for his creation. We see him actively pursuing her endgame in regards to bringing about the Age of Stars, despite his very nature. Yet his nature, it remains. And no matter what Blythe wants, we begin to understand that while in Blythe's mind and heart, he may be Rani's creature, in his soul, he is really no more than a tool for the Two Fingers. E.G. concisely explains this situation, and simultaneously reveals the nature of a shadow-bound beast.
The Two Fingers gave Blythe to Lady Rani as a faithful follower. Her very shadow, incapable of treachery. But if Lady Rani, as an Empyrean, resists being an instrument of the Two Fingers, the shadow will go mad, transforming from a follower into a horrid curse. But such is his destiny. In such matters, Blythe's own thoughts hold no weight. It pains me so. But he must be neutralized, for Lady Rani's sake.
So not only are shadows granted to help Empyreans claim godhood, but they are also the insurance policies of the Two Fingers in a way. If that Empyrean were to make themselves an enemy, or diverge from the will of the Greater Will, to shake off their obeisance, if you would, then the shadows would become the assassin and slit the throat of their master. But perhaps that is too simplistic an explanation, though a concise one it is. Does in fact E.G. mean that because of the contradictory nature of Blythe's situation, i.e. serving a goal that is opposition to his very purpose, is paradoxical, and it is this that drives him mad? I believe that this is closer to the truth, though the far more explanation of him as an insurance policy does a more concise job of illustrating the same end result. Either way, what this highlights is, despite the nature of their creation, the Shadowbound can develop their own personalities and ideals. Blythe is loyal to Rani, not the Two Fingers, in his mind. He doesn't understand why E.G. would lock him away, for in his heart he is 100% Rani's man. If we talk to him when he is in the Everjail, he says the following.
Oh, it's you. It's me, Blythe. Old E.G. trapped me here. Told me I'd bring naught but bail to Lady Rani. But there's no chance that could happen. I'm part of a being. A very shadow. I thought old E.G. knew as much. Honestly, I don't know what's going on anymore.
It is sad watching the deterioration of Blythe, because despite his heart, he is ultimately a creation of the Fingers. And he does appear to succumb to his conflicting reality, before throwing himself at us in a rage and we have to put him down, showing that the true masters of the Shadowbound are their two Fingers. Blythe's fate shows the ultimate nature of these beasts. While real, independent beings, the two Fingers are still their creators, and such can compel them to such drastic action. Or, do we consider that he did actually resist in his mind? For after we tell E.G. of Blythe's death, it seems almost implied that E.G. was wrong about his assumptions of Blythe's nature.
Unthinkable. How could Blythe? How did he break free from his cell? More importantly, Blythe became a curse that plagued Lady Rani. Yet even in madness, gave himself to her. I've made a grave misjudgment. And I thought myself a capable war counselor. I'll catch up with you soon enough, Blythe. When I do, I only hope you'll accept my apology.
Furthermore, Rani says the following of Blythe.
Even when I turned my back upon the Two Fingers, Blythe remained my loyal ally. Though he was created a vassal for an Empyrean, he was a colossal failure on the part of the Two Fingers, Blythe and E.G. both. Art willing to give too much to me, yet they both understand what lieth beyond the dark path, that I must betray everything and rid the world of what came before. Ah. Should I add thee to the list? Another one, kind of heart. As kind of heart as they.
At the very least, it shows that the Two Fingers had not anticipated that a Shadowbound would have remained loyal to a traitor for as long as he did. And even at the very end, Blythe rails against his fate, professing his undying loyalty to his dearest Rani, part of his very being. I do think that Rani is right in that he is a failure of the Two Fingers. For even if his paradoxical role does catch up with him and he does eventually go mad, Blythe did serve Rani's rebellion against the Fingers for a long time, showing that it was a failure on the part of the Two Fingers. Now that we have covered the creation and purpose of these beasts, I want to talk about their mortality. In the latest episode of my podcast, Jolly Cooperation, myself, Zyostorm, and the Lore Hunter had an interesting discussion regarding Malekith, and you should 100% check it out. In the comments section, a viewer, Quincy, made a really interesting remark regarding the nature of these beasts that has stuck with me. They pointed out the fact that Blythe, when you kill him early on in the game, says the following.
You're strong of arm, but ask yourself, what harm can be done to a shadow?
Quincy suggests that this line, and I agree with them, implies that shadows may not die so easily in the normative corporeal sense, and even goes as far to suggest that this may be how Garank can exist in two locations wholly independently, for even if you kill Malekith, Garank still exists. I think this is a great idea, and while it is speculation, I certainly think Blythe's line suggests that shadows are not so easy to kill, and I thank Quincy for highlighting this point about the shadow beast's mortality. To take this further, I would agree and speculate that a shadow can only truly be killed if their bond with their Empyrean is fully severed. They are bound creatures, and to me this suggests that their fate is tied to that of their master. They are bound. In Blythe's case, I would suggest that he would only be truly destroyed when Rani destroys her Two Fingers, fully severing her connection with the Greater Will, who granted her Blythe in the first place. Speculation, but it does offer a satisfying option as to when we consider the mortality of these beasts. Before moving on from this subject, I wanted to touch on something else. The Baleful Shadows.
O Shadow, thou art the last. Tell the Two Fingers that Rani the Witch cometh to rend thy flesh with a fateful wound, ne'er to heal.
Rani describes these as the assassins of the Finger, unleashed against her due to her choices that she has made. Yet these shadows are Blythe copies, are they not? This makes sense to me. Blythe is also a shadow creation of the Fingers, but he is a complex creation capable of myriad actions and independent decision making. he is a true companion to his Empyrean. As the name of these baleful shadows suggest, these are also shadows created by the Fingers, but with a singular, simple purpose. As such, they look and move like Blythe because they are generated by the same process by the two Fingers as a normal Shadowbound is made. I believe that these shadows therefore are also connected to Rani, as Blythe is, and this is why she needs these shadows eliminated, so she can fully shed her attachment to the two Fingers. With Blythe eliminated and the shadows severed, Rani is able to fully rid herself of her two Fingers. This begs the question, did Rani know that Blythe would die? Is she so callous as to carry out her plans even knowing the fate of her childhood friend? I would suggest yes. We find him surrounded by Black Knife assassins. Their master, Rani of course, and by the end of the quest, all three of her counselors are dead. Two out of three of them surrounded by Black Knife assassins. A convenient tying up of loose ends, and something to consider for those who think that Rani can do no wrong. We of course cannot discuss the Shadowbound beasts without talking about the greatest among their number, Malekith. The Black Blade is no different in displaying his own personality and absolute loyalty to his Empyrean. We have already discussed a few of the in-game lore references to Malekith through our discussion, but let's review the story of this fascinating character from start to finish, because I believe there are a few details that some may have not picked up on. Firstly, I'm sure that most are aware of this, but let's just cover it anyway. Garank is Malekith's alter ego. Garank's quest ties in with Malekith's appearance later, and his dialogue can differ depending on how much of Garank's quest you have done. And finally, of course, we can see the Rune of Death plate on Garank's hand and Malekith's hand during the cinematic. To reinforce they are one and the same, we can look at the item description for the Stone of Garank, a incantation, which reads as follows. Long ago, Garank was a beast of such terrifying ferocity that his former name meant Death of the Demigods. So Garank is the quote-unquote unassuming appearance that Garank would have taken following the Knight of the Black Knives. So let's review Malekith's past and we will return to this new identity. As we learned from his remembrance, Malekith was given to Marika when she became an Empyrean. Much as Rani uses Blythe for her own ends, likewise does Marika use Malekith for her own ends. The coming of Malekith as we know him, the Death of the Demigods, centres around the apostasy led by the Glowmied Queen and her Godskin movement. After this event, as the Blasphemous Claw item description states, Malekith would essentially become known as the Black Beast of Destined Death, a being synonymous with death. I speak on this event in great detail in my lore video, The God Hunt, which I will link below, so I won't retread that subject in as much detail in this video. But suffice it to say, the Godskins and their Glowmied Queen, an Empyrean, wielded Destined Death through the power of the Godslaying Black Flame. It is heavily suggested that this power was being used against Marika and her regime, given it was Malekith who would ultimately defeat the Godskin movement, and of course Malekith answers to Marika. Indeed, we get confirmation from the Godslayer Greatsword that it was Malekith that defeated the Glowmied Queen, and ultimately the Godskin movement as a whole. Again, confirming the Godskin's target was Marika's brood. We know from the Scouring Black Flame item description that prior to Malekith sealing Destined Death, these apostates were able to slay the gods with the power of the Black Flame. It would be the sealing of the Rune of Death within Malekith's weapon that would therefore lead to their defeat, for the description of his Black Blade reads, Malekith's Black Blade, which once harboured the power of the Rune of Death, a sad shadow of its former glory. After a fragment of death was stolen on that fateful night, Malekith bound the blade within his own flesh, such that none might ever rob death again. Malekith's armor description reinforces Malekith's infamy for wielding the power of Destined Death, as it reads, Beast's armor, made of black iron and decorated with gold, worn by Malekith the Black Blade. Malekith, Queen Marika's loyal half-brother, bore a blade imbued with Destined Death, and there was not one demigod who did not fear him. Champions knew what was at stake. So I'll try to unpack this as best as I can, but some of what will follow will be my interpretation and speculation, so you have been warned. Malekith's remembrance states that he was needed to seal away Destined Death, and so it is logical that this need arose when Marika's rule was threatened by the Glowmied Queen. Bear in mind, the Glowmied Queen was an Empyrean, and therefore someone capable of assuming Marika's place, and with the godslaying power of Destined Death at her disposal, This was a very real possibility. The Black Blade and Malekith armour description makes it clear that the Rune of Death, i.e. the source of death and death, was harboured within his own weapon, meaning not only would he be the only wielder of death and death, but that he could also seal its power solely within this sword. I believe therefore that when threatened by the Glomide Queen and her Godskin Apostles, Marika had the Rune of Death sealed away by Malekith, and he became its seal. Yet, unlike in his guise of Garank, he wielded it in a flamboyant and dangerous manner, literally wielding it within his blade as a powerful weapon that would have caused fear amongst the gods. This is as described by his Black Blade and armour description, but it simultaneously also sapped the power of the Godskin movement out of their black flame. As it was sealed solely within his sword, he was the vessel for death and death, meaning it could no longer be wielded by the Godskin Apostles and the Glomide Queen. This would have crippled the Godskin movement, and simultaneously granted Malekith the immense power needed to defeat an Empyrean, the Glomide Queen. This would be why the demigods would fear him. His wielding of death and death literally within his own blade, the only thing that can truly slay a god, and his defeat of an Empyrean, would serve as an example for all who wish to rebel against Marika's and the Golden Order's rule. Malekith would become a significant figure within the Pantheon himself, that he would have his own followers and warriors. For example, we have the Black Blade Kindred, which are gargoyles that serve Malekith, such as the one that guards the entrance to his sanctum in Caelid. Their weapon item descriptions, for example the Black Blade, tell us of how they mark their service to Malekith, for it reads, "Bronze greatsword wielded by valiant gargoyles, mended within blackened corpse wax, deals holy damage. Such is the mark of those who serve Malekith, the Black Blade." So we see here that those who serve Malekith mark themselves with black corpse wax, a fitting tribute to their lord. Being it corpse wax, it is representative of their lord's position as a wielder of death, and black, of course, for the Black Blade. Indeed, if we take a closer look at these gargoyles, we can see that they are more or less the same as the regular valiant gargoyles, except instead of being marked with regular gold wax, they are marked with black wax. Looking even more closely, we can see a further indicator of their loyalties, for they also don the grey mane of Malekith upon their helms. Indeed, they do seem to be doing the work of Malekith, for one guards his master, and the other guards the Mountain of the Giants and the Forbidden Flame. I would also suggest that the Vulgar Militia serve under Malekith as his agents. For one, they clearly use his bestial claw incantation, and second, some of their blades seem to be imbued with her of death and death, as they give off a red similar to Malekith. Their armour set suggests that despite their vulgar nature, they are misunderstood and unsung heroes, posing as watchmen, clearly under Malekith's direction, sealing off areas forbidden by the Golden Order, such as Mountains of the Giants and Fire Mazula. Indeed, we find them in the Forbidden Lands, alongside a Blackblade Kindred, suggesting that the Vulgar Militia, alongside the Blackblade Kindred, comprise a quarantine force under Malekith's orders, and together they are the agents of the Black Blade. Yet his wielding of the Rune of Death would later be exploited by Rani and her co-conspirators. As we all know by this point, the Black Knife Assassins would successfully steal fragments of the Rune of Death, marking their blades with its power and using it to slay Godwin's soul and Rani's Empyrean flesh. It would be at this point that Garank would be born. No longer would he wield death and death so openly, he would hide it. Malekith sealed the sword, and therefore the rune, within his own body, so it would not be so easily stolen. And again, we learn this from the item description of his Black Blade itself. He would then also adopt a very clever disguise, that of the Beast Cleric. I discussed and hashed out some of the lore regarding Garank's purpose in my podcast with the Lore Hunter and Xiostorm that we recorded back in April, so I recommend checking out my earlier thoughts and some of their thoughts on this matter. So while it may be suggested to some that Garank was Malekith's original form or his original identity before he became Malekith and he's just reverting to it, I would disagree. I think that Rani's dialogue makes it pretty clear that the shadows of the Empyrean are tailor-made, created, and presented by the Greater Will and the Two Fingers. Therefore, they would not have any previous identity. And that is just my thoughts, but I think Rani's dialogue makes that pretty clear. It seems that Malekith wanted to keep himself to himself and keep the Rune of Death hidden. And we can tell this from his dialogue when we fight him, that he is pretty desperate to resist a similar outcome. And at the beginning of the very fight, for example, he says, "I will not have it stolen from me again." And if he kills you, he says, "I shall not part with it again," making it pretty clear that he is here to keep the Dess and Death away from anyone. His dagger, the Cincti, can give us some clues to what Garank persona is all about, for its item description reads, "Short sword given to high-ranking clergymen of Farum Azula, raises potency of bestial incantations. The design celebrates a beast's five fingers, symbolic of the intelligence once granted upon their kind." So there is clearly more to say about the beastmen, their fingers, and the relationship with the dragons, but these things deserve their own content, and we will get to that in a future video at some point. The passage here that I want to focus on from the Cincti is that this dagger is awarded to high-ranking clergy of Farum Azula. This is massive because it shows us what Garank is all about. He's buried himself in the society present within the crumbling city, disguising himself as Garank, the Beastman, a Beastman, not a Shadow Beast, and even gaining a position within their ranks. In addition, he uses his persona to work with Tarnished in order to clean up a mess which he has caused by collecting Deathroot, a side effect of the Knight of the Black Knives. Garank's dialogue in the Bestial Sanctum suggests that he is hungering to ingest all of this material, and suggests that this appetite is overlapped and connected to his own sense of sin, for he states,
"Feed me more, Death. It is all consumed. Still, I am not sated. Not nearly sated." America, is this what it is to sin? Will things never be the same again? Tarnished, my thanks for thy long labor. But I have done all I can in this land. Henceforth, mine appetite shall be my sole companion."
It's almost as if Malekith, being the bearer of the Rune of Death, can feel part of it is absent, like a hunger that can only be temporarily sated by Deathroot, which essentially is fragments of the Rune of Death that was stolen.
Put it away. I won't forget again. Mine appetite. My sin.
This hunger seems to genuinely consume him, showing how closely intertwined he is with the Rune of Death that he is buried within himself. And this is illustrated when he goes berserk and attacks us. This is no surprise, given that Deathroot is born of that stolen fragment of the rune within him, as the description of Deathroot reads, "On the night of the dire plot, the stolen Rune of Death enabled the first death of a demigod. Later, the Rune of Death spread across the lands between through the underground roots of the great tree, sprouting in the form of Deathroot." So this is how I see Garank. He is Malekith's form of penance, hiding the Rune of Death instead of brandishing it brazenly, as he did in days past, whilst working with the Tarnished to try and gather up the missing fragments of the stolen Rune of Death. Yet now we come to an elephant in the room, Malekith's relationship with Marika, and ultimately what his final orders were, and how much he knew of Marika's final plan. It mentions that Marika betrayed Malekith in his remembrance, and I believe the reason it says this is pretty straightforward. If you defeat Malekith in Farum Azula, but also after completing Garank's questline fully, then he will essentially apologize to Marika for stating that the Golden Order cannot be restored, for failing to protect the Golden Order, essentially. What follows is my speculation, but clearly it suggests that at some point Marika did want him to hide Death and Death and go about reclaiming the lost shards of the rune, or at least he felt compelled to, due to Marika's aims and objectives at the time. However, if we kill Malekith as Garank in the Bestial Sanctum, he appears hurt and surprised by Marika's actions in shattering the Elden Ring, for he says this.
Why wouldst thou gull me? Why shatter?
This to me is the betrayal that is referred to in the Remembrance of the Black Blade, as this line makes it clear that Malekith had no hand in whatever Marika had done or planned after the Night of the Black Knives. He saw the theft of the Rune of Death, his failure in protecting Marika's order, but then Marika would go and shatter the Elden Ring anyway, making him feel like a fool. And specifically he uses the term gull, which means to fool or deceive, and it is easy to sympathise with Malekith here, given all he has gone through, the guilt and sin that he feels in his self-imposed penance, only for Marika to shatter the Elden Ring, rendering the whole point of it moot. So this is how I see Malekith, once a proud and mighty champion of Marika's order, reduced to live a life of penance and guilt, but still loyal to his oath. An oath he'll eventually die defending, but ultimately it means little because Marika betrays his loyalty by rendering his oath useless by shattering the Elden Ring. So there are of course two other Empyreans that were chosen by the Fingers, Mikola and Melania, and it begs the questions, who are their Shadowbound beasts? In short, for me, we just don't see them in the game, but we have to assume that they did have one. Rani mentions them as being elected as Empyreans in the same breath that she tells us about being granted a Blythe. We have to consider that Mikola and Melania have chosen a path contrary to the greater will. Please see my really in-depth video on the subject to understand how Mikola's new order stands in opposition to the Golden Order. So it could have been that the twins have already dealt with or abandoned their shadows, similar to how we see Rani having to deal with hers in her questline. It could also simply be that they have in fact sent them on missions, much as Blythe still serves Rani on missions. I've seen a lot of speculation that Melania is in fact Mikola's shadow, given that she has his blade. And whilst I agree this is of course a symbolic allusion to that relationship, it is that only. She has effectively taken on the role. She isn't a true Shadowbound. Of course she is herself an Empyrean, and ultimately can transform into a god herself, the Goddess of Rot, something clearly beyond a true Shadowbound. So no, Melania is not a finger-given shadow to Mikola, and I think we simply do not see the twin Shadowbound in-game. So we of course cannot talk about the Shadowbound beasts without dealing with a serious elephant in the room, the Bloodhound Knights. Let us start the discussion by reading the item description for their armour, which reads, "The Bloodhound Knights are trained as hunters and known to be unshakable trackers. Without the use of language, each knight chooses his own master. Once the decision has been made, the knight stays loyal for life." So we can instantly see here some similarities between the Bloodhounds and the Shadowbound. Firstly, the term hound makes us think of the wolfen nature of Shadowbound beasts, as alluded to by Vargrim's armor set. Second is the very nature of their service. As described by this description, Bloodhound knights attach themselves to one master and serve them for life, much as a shadow serves one Empyrean for their whole life. The Strayhound flow shows how important these bonds are to their creed, for it reads, "Spirit of a Bloodhound knight called the Rabid Stray. Flo once vowed there was only one lord he would ever serve, a true king, and so the rabid stray never found a master." Much like the Shadowbound, Bloodhounds are bound to a single lord. However, this description does also highlight an important difference between the Shadowbound and the Bloodhounds, but we will return to that in a moment. The Bloodhounds also behave and move like wolves as well. They don't use language like other humans, and of course their very movement, being on all fours, is very reminiscent of their four-legged counterparts. Even their weapons, the claws and fangs, are meant to replicate the authentic claw and tooth of a hound. So it does beg the question, is there a connection between the Bloodhounds and the Shadowbounds? Are they something that becomes Shadowbound later on? In short, no, I think that the Bloodhounds are mainly inspired by the Shadowbounds' relationship, and they use this inspiration as their creed. As I will argue more in the next chapter about Vargrim, the Shadowbound are created, not trained, and they are tailor-made to be the most useful form for their particular Imperian, whereas the Bloodhounds become the way they are through rigorous training and by following their particular ideals. Another clear difference is the way in which the Bloodhounds become bound. This is very different. As we saw by the Ashes of Flow, the Bloodhounds choose their master, they make a choice, whereas the Shadowbound are given to their masters and created for them. Yet they are clearly analogous to the Shadowbound. To me, much like Vargrim, this Brotherhood's organisation is a creed, clearly inspired to reflect the cosmic bond of Shadow Beast and Imperian, but achieves it in a more earthly manner, through training and discipline. And in fact, there is actually one Bloodhound Knight that we encounter during Blythe's quest, so it is worth discussing it. The first time we meet Blythe is when he wants our assistance in locating a quote-unquote traitor, who's called Darrowill, who turns out to be a Bloodhound Knight. So why is this Bloodhound Knight a traitor? Well, most obviously, we can assume that Darrowill was a sworn Bloodhound in service to Rani, much as their creed dictates, and he could have simply abandoned his oath and abandoned Rani, therefore marking himself as a traitor to Blythe. But we can go a bit further into this, if you allow me some speculation, for we can find the Black Wolf mask near Celebus's Rives, a mask that clearly imitates Blythe's visage, and its description reads the following. A mask fashioned after the head of a black wolf. Relic of an assassin who assumed the guise of Rani the Witch's loyal shadow. The likeness is striking. So at some point someone disguised themselves as Blythe in an attempt to kill Rani. Would it not make sense that the would-be assassin could very well be a being who could easily pass for a half-wolf in movement? As well as possibly being close to Rani and Blythe already, if he is sworn to their court. And it could also neatly explain why Blythe is so determined to hunt him down, and so ruthlessly calls him a traitor. It is just speculation, but it is a story that I choose to believe, as it fits the little bits of jigsaw pieces that we find in this story. So let us come full circle in the concluding subject of this video, Vargrim, the man who would become the shadow to an Imperian through choice. Yet whose shadow is he attempting to become? Well, we are never outright told, but I believe the Imperian he is seeking is the Glomite Queen. Not only is she one of the only missing Imperians in-game, but Vargrim himself wields the Godslayer Greatsword, her once iconic weapon. And whilst it might be just a random sword given to Vargrim by the developers, I find that very little in From Software games are done by chance. So, is his quest fruitless, or is it something he can achieve? I think that Vargrim is playing the role or trope that we have seen quite often in Dark Souls games before. A powerful warrior that ultimately embarks on a fruitless quest to achieve that is simply beyond his grasp, and it ends in his doom. I feel we see similar paths tread by Solaire in his quest to claim the sun, and by Hawkwood in his quest to become a dragon. Both powerful warriors, both meeting pitiful ends. As I discussed in the previous chapter, I do not believe that one can become Shadowbound. Rani's speech to us makes it so clear that these creatures are created by the Two Fingers. They are created and tailored specifically for their Imperian. They are tailor-made. They are not born and then become a Shadowbound. They are created for this role alone, attached already to their Imperian. They are provided in the form that they are, in the form of a vassal suitable for an Imperian, and are created in their shadow. And as I discussed at the beginning of this video, I believe that each shadow is born tied to their Imperian and are in essence part of their very being, to quote Blythe. Vargrim is not part of the Glomite Queen, and he was not born this way. He is a man, and sadly his quest would end in failure. As one of the first Tarnished to sit at Round Table Hold, we can assume this quest has been a long one, and as of yet, he still remains a human. His story sadly ends at the end of a recusant blade, his power claimed for the cause of their rebellious Taker Lord. So thanks guys, that is my take on the Shadowbound Beasts of the Imperian, as well as other related subjects. If you like this video, please consider giving me a subscribe and a like, as I do Elden Ring content almost primarily at the moment. If you'd like to support the channel another way, please consider becoming a member of the channel. I do member-only posts and you get cool little member badges and emojis, and I will be doing some members-only FAQ content in the future when I have the time to do so. But apart from that, guys, please let me know your thoughts in the comments below, what you'd like me to tackle next, but until next time, I will see you on the battlefields of the Shattering. Take care.